been feasting my eyes on the clouds. They're like a sky from another era or another world, not this world. I think they must be coming from the hurricanes that are coming from the south. They're big cumulus clouds that are many levels and many shapes, the kind you can lie on your back and find a sheep in it and a face in it and an elephant. As usual, my big study is how to be this and do this practice in a lay context, so-called. From my side, as I was telling my hair cutter the other day, my effort is to try to maintain a space for people. He said, "What is teaching? Teaching? How can you teach it?" And I said, "Oh, you can't. Of course, that's the wrong word. But we don't know what other word to use for it. So we say teaching, but we need to create and maintain a space where people can come and have enough peace and quiet to discover their own truth." And he looked at me and he said, "Well, in that case, everyone is a teacher." I said, "Yeah, good work, Kevin." And that's what I'm reading in Hakuin. I'm reading a new book that came out of some of Hakuin Senji's talks. He lived in the 1600s-1700s in Japan, in view of Mount Fuji on the edge of the sea, and was a very wonderful and ferocious Rinzai teacher. And all the teachings in this little book are about how to do the practice after Satori. In Rinzai practice, they aim for Satori, and then some experience occurs, usually through solving koans. He was kind of a renegade. He made up his own koans. He didn't use the old ones necessarily. He had his own. "What's the sound of one hand clapping" is his. That's the first one you have to solve in his lineage. But then what he emphasizes over and over in these talks is after Satori. Number one, he says that we have many, many Satoris in our life, and that if we hold on to the one that we've had, there's no space for any new one to come in. And anything that's a memory isn't real, in any case. So we can't ride on whatever insights we've achieved, so-called, although it's not even an achievement. It's an experience. And in my experience, we've all come to sitting in the first place through some kind of Satori experience. We wouldn't be doing this if we hadn't connected with something in ourselves that seems to require this. Not even seems to, does require this. But then the question is how to sustain this practice. And one of the things Hakuin says is that the tendency is to say, "Ah, I got it. something happened and I got it. So now I can just go off and do whatever I want to do. It's cool. I'm cool. And it's fine. And we enter a world of suffering. Because that kind of self-satisfaction closes oneself off to awareness of the truth of everything else. We become shut away again. Because Satori, or insight, or whatever that is, the experience is an occasion of opening up, an occasion of light. And darkness, which is what ignorance is called, is exactly not being able any longer to see. To see the light. So, what I see in my own life and in those that I know who've been doing this practice for a long time, we go in and out of enthusiasm for it, in and out of being moved by it and helped by it. One of the stumbling blocks and kind of blunder is that it always, almost always begins because we are troubled in some way in our own mind and life. But as we continue to practice, it opens up and it becomes about our relationship with everyone and everything, relationship with our life itself. But as we close down again, we lose that relationship. We lose that connection. And it becomes all about me again. So what Hakuin talks about is that the second most important thing, having once fallen in love with practice, or been fallen in love with by practice, you could say, it's important to carry it forward into life. It's important to share it, to share the Dharma. And that, of course, is the Bodhisattva vow. So instead of taking oneself as the primary model of how to do and how to be, it's the whole occasion, the contingent occasion of all things as they flow through our life, and as we are able to live as and through it. And the only way that I know to do that, to be that, is to continue sitting. It doesn't take a lot of sitting to change the brainwaves radically. And once we've experienced Zazen and had enough experience to have changed our brainwaves a number of times, it gets easier. We recognize a state, not of the brain, actually. We recognize a state of body, But without that experience, and without cultivating that experience, the rest of it isn't possible. It just becomes an idea, another idea. So that the Metta Sutra that we just practiced, all those wonderful little instructions about how to be, arise from sitting practice itself. That whole intention of the Metta Sutra is coming from some poet's insight and is expressed in words. But the insight comes from this practice. And without it, it's just ideas. Yes, yes, I'll try to be good. And we can restrict ourselves in many ways and try really hard to be not hatred and not wanting too many things and trying to love everybody. There was an old cartoon in the New Yorker of a lady telling her husband with open arms, "I love the universe." And he's saying, "Well, you damn well better." But it's just an idea. The reality, really, we can hardly say. But we do. We live and breathe it. It is our life in breath. Hakuin's shtick is interesting because he suffered terribly from Zazen sickness. He tried so hard. He was traumatized when he was a child. He had heard an old priest lecturing about hell, the hell realms, and how terrifying they were. He described it so vividly that the young boy just freaked out completely. He was so afraid. And he brought that into his zazen when he became a practicer in his teens and was trying to sit through it. And sit and sit and sit. And he would sit up all night, he and a buddy, for days on end. And it just got worse and worse. He kept trying for something, you know, to. And he went to many different teachers and begged them to help him, and nobody could help him. Finally, he went to an old hermit who lived in a cave outside of Kyoto. And the old hermit wasn't even a Buddhist, but he knew what to do. And he said, "Imagine that you have butter on the top of your head, and that as you're sitting, slowly the butter seeps down inside, and very slowly just begins to fill you up with the softness and sweetness of butter. And if you keep your mind on your hara, you'll be fine." And over, Hakuin comes back to this place. He said, if you can just live your life from this place, if you can walk around town and go to the grocery store from this place, he says, you'll be fine. But this place, of course, is the zazen place. This is where we drop ourselves into as we sit. Though we tend to come back up and race around in our mind about all the things we have to do, we can drop ourselves back down into our body. That butter thing is just about accepting and being this body just as we are. And let it be as it is. and as it wants to be. He says, and he has a whole series of poems, that there's an old lady who lives down here. The old lady has a little house down there. And she's the one who's the mind. That's the real mind. We don't have to worry so much about what to do because this old lady is already taking care of everything. It's a very funny idea. But not so funny when we think about how the mind works, how the whole nervous system works. It's true that we don't know what we think or what we do until after. It's true on every level. They're finding it in more and more places. So it really comes down to trusting this part. Allowing ourselves not to have to run the whole show out of our heads. We need our head. We need to figure things out. But so much we can't figure out is already being taken care of. And we can trust it. So my hope about this place and what we do here is that it's an encouragement for not just coming and sitting together like this, which is so helpful. Being a sangha together is extremely helpful. But if it's just a one-time or two-time-a-week thing, it's pretty fragile. So I would encourage you, in the name of Hakuin Zenji, to try to cultivate a daily practice and be serious about it. Not just on automatic, like brushing our teeth, though I often say, you know, factor it in. We always brush our teeth, we always sit. But not like brushing teeth as an automatic thing, but as a completely determined moment. A moment when we truly accept the moment and enter it and be there at least for a little while. This is kind of a pep talk for myself, too. I come out of Sesshin and I think, whew, you know, that was a lot of sitting. Well, now, let's take a little vacation. And then I start looking at my life and looking at how my mind goes, and I begin to see it's kind of going off in some way. And it becomes a big issue again. How can we live this life? How can we bear witness to our experience and share it? Because that's what we do. If we live a life of zazen, then whatever we do and whoever we're with, we're sharing it with. Not out loud with words, but with our very being. Are there any questions? Ron?
I read part of this book that came out, I don't know if it's the same one that you're reading, it was kind of a selection of his talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he reminded me of some kind of fundamentalist Christian fire and brimstone preacher sometimes.
Yeah.
He's really, gosh, he's really fervor, and if you stray from a true teaching, you know, or you claim to be, you know, have enlightenment and really don't, you are going to be punished in hell and you're going to suffer this and this and this. And he even goes into details.
Yes. Because yes. He's been there.
He's a, which I hadn't, you know, associated so much with Zen Buddhist practice. I mean, I know that Zen's a
yes.
Pretty serious soto, a little more kind of methodical and slow. But I simply, in fact, I almost ordered the book. I haven't ordered it, but yeah, it's quite interesting. But I, maybe that's his, what you're getting at, you know, don't get lazy. You
know. Yes. Yeah, essentially that's what he's saying.
In our case, you know, I started sitting pretty much every morning when I can, if I don't get interrupted by somebody in the family who gets up and comes downstairs. Downstairs in the family room. So if somebody comes down, I kind of really don't feel like just sitting in front of me. But I'm much too old. So I found out I had to make it a habit. You know, you mentioned brushing your teeth or whatever else our habits might be. You know, making coffee, whatever.
Yeah.
But once it becomes a habit, then it's a habit. And if you don't do it, it doesn't.
Yes.
Oh, gosh, it does.
Yeah.
But that, it really works that way for me. And it took me, I can't tell you how many years. Mm. I thought about, oh, it would be good to sit every morning. Finally, over the last year or so, I pretty much do. I'm not every morning, but more often than not. So then it becomes a habit. And by the same token, going through your day, somehow doing your practice, maybe not so consciously, or not even so worrying, so, oh my God, am I being mindful? Did I do this? But, you know, just getting used to being that way.
Yeah.
That's practice. Thank you very much.
Yeah. I have a friend who used to say, never on Sunday.
Oh.
She'd get the Sunday paper and skip Sazen on Sunday, and somehow that made it okay to do it for the rest of the week. You know, I think we trick ourselves in various ways. But I'm the same as you, Ron. I have to make it a certain time every day. And if I know that time is just for that, then it feels very strange not to do it.
I don't know, Hakrin, I haven't read him, you know, I've tried to get what he's... Does he mean all this stuff literally?
It's hard to tell.
Do you believe in hell and you're going to go down there and the devil? I mean, you've got to be poked with sharp fingers and stabbed and tormented if you deviate, or is it just imagery? I don't know.
He was an artist, very, very brilliant artist. And he made beautiful paintings, Sumier, just black and white, of Avalokiteshvara in every different kind of way, with flowers and water and very simple, very rapid strokes. And he made devils and Mara. You know, he cultivated that side too as a kind of balance, I think, because we can't just think this is all about sweetness and light. This is about our suffering and the suffering in the world. And trying to find ways of expressing that and acknowledging and accepting that is our practice. So he, I don't know, since he started out being so terrified of hell, how he ended up actually thinking about it. But at least psychologically, we know hell realms. We know them very, very well. And there are many.
This is actually fairly unrelated to what you were talking about, I think. I don't think it really fits, but you're talking about, I guess I was thinking about what meditation does. And I know maybe I just have been mis-listening for a couple of years, because I know I've been thinking of like Manjushri and cutting through delusion and things like that. And I know that meditation helps me see a lot of my experiences more than, and that's been very helpful, but I've been reading a book called Stumbling on Happiness, and in it, the author, whose name I can't recall at the moment, is very sciencey. It's about sort of the studies that have gone on how people experience life. And in it, he argues that healthy delusion is very important for just surviving and wanting to keep surviving. And I thought that was interesting, and I was wondering how that interacts with this idea of cutting through, or maybe just seeing through, the delusions we cook up to get through. He argues that actually we always expect bad events will be much worse because we don't realize we're going to come up with very good explanations for all this. And that helps us afterwards, the very good explanations, but it's still not necessarily anything that's true. It's just...
So he's talking about expectations as...
Well, just bad events, actually. We always expect a bad event.
I see.
But in fact, after it happens, our brain comes up with all these reasons why this really isn't that terrible. And none of them are necessarily true, but it might be important to take them and keep going with them to make it bearable. And I was wondering how that sort of, I felt persuaded by this,
yes.
This view that, yeah, I guess some delusion. And so how does that interact with Zen? And it's, I don't know, I think we often talk about truth and seeing through delusion and ending delusions.
Yes, even ending delusion.
Yeah. So, I don't know. What about that?
Well, Zen goes in a slightly different direction.
Okay.
That's very useful in how to deal with our disappointments,
yeah.
Or
knowing that we will be.
Knowing that we will be. It's very practical advice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not really addressing what's really going on.
Okay.
And Zen is much more interested in what's really going on. So it goes, it's more complicated. So we're all working in a diluted way.
Mm-hmm.
And it is more like seeing through in Zen. Mm-hmm. We can't erase all our delusions because we don't even know what they are.
Yeah.
But we can certainly try to see through them as we go through our life. And that's what the Manjushri thing is about. Because once they're seen through, they have no power anymore.
And what starts as a nice, helpful story can
yes.
become
yes.
something you need to... Okay, and I guess maybe the implication of the book was that if we didn't have these delusions, life would be very hard. And is then saying, well, yeah, but then at least you know it's hard.
Yes.
And also it offers a way of being okay, calm with the...
Yes. Yes. And it offers a way to suffer with others rather than just being miserable ourselves. That we open ourselves up to everything and begin to experience the suffering that's actually happening. Experience the world as it is, not just from our own point of view, but from a much wider view.
And I can see how that would be very important. Lots of things in the world, you think if only people would just pay attention.
Yes, yes.
And so I can see how well it might help them get through their day. It's really not necessarily net gaining.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Sounds like an interesting book.
It's very good. Mm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I kind of needed that pep talk that I've been going through. I mean, it wasn't really a pep talk, but I experienced that same thing, and I was thinking, well, everything's going fine, you know. Life is fine, no big problems, you know. Most of the things that work that were bad happen. It's settling down, and nothing really, and, you know. Well, I sit, but gosh, I really can't get into it sometimes, you know. I'm sitting here like, oh gosh, like my mind's still wandering, and I'm not really having these deep experiences exactly.
No.
But that's just the way it is.
Yes.
But how do, is that important? Should I really, wouldn't it be better if I did? I don't know.
You can't make anything happen. Ever.
Yeah.
Ever. It's out of our hands.
So,
in fact, we put ourselves into our hands and just say, go for it.
And then sometimes, this is interesting, you know. I remember when I started practicing at the Berkeley Zen back in the 70s, I felt, now looking back, I feel, oh gosh, everybody was pretty immature in a way. Or not everybody, but there was sort of a immaturity, and people took it really seriously, or seemed to on the outside. And I thought I was, you know, people wouldn't go to Tassajara. So, but in order to go to Tassajara, you had to, you know, sort of prove yourself. You had to really go to Zendo and sit a lot, and I don't know if you had to fill out an application or be authorized to go there or something that's, you know, really something you could almost never be good enough to do, certainly not me at the time. And I never got there. Then I went to a little seminar that Haigen Van Leyden gave earlier this summer, so it's a Bodhisattva archetype. It wasn't this regular practice period, so it was kind of like a resort. It's this Zen resort in the summer. It's very nice. I mean, you have the food, but you only sit. You know, you have the option of sitting at 5 a.m. and then they have a regular sit-up. But I found that I had so much expectation mentally built up about what Tassajara was going to be. It was like, you know, this grand place in the middle of Nirvana, and it was going to be really something. But I found my first sitting in the morning was pretty phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
Like all of this kind of whatever, just something happened, you know, in terms of something that I experienced. And then after that, it was these young kids trying to tell me where to go and what to do after I've been sitting for 30 years. Oh, they're young kids. They're this. That's good. about it. And I wasn't serious because it was the summer thing. But anyway, it goes. This is a long tangent, but it goes back to what you said. You know, sometimes something's going to happen in the sitting and practice just out of the blue.
Yeah.
And you don't know.
Yeah.
Kind of lay that groundwork or opening you up to that. Opening yourself up to that possibility of something could come up, and you might have the satori, or you might not, or maybe you only thought you did, but that's what it's all about. At least you're on the track where you have that possibility, which you always have. Mm-hmm. They say it's always here, right in front of us.
Yeah.
We just can't see it.
Yeah.
But somehow it comes out when it's ready, or when we're ready. Mm-hmm. But it's really easy to get into some routine.
Yes, that's part of it. That's a big part of it.
Oh gosh. I do this every day. What's supposed to happen?
Yeah. Is it happening now?
I don't know. That's why I say thank you for the talk.
Coben said it's like sending many love letters and waiting for an answer.
It's interesting to have somebody else share that and look more with your insight. Because I've been kind of looking at it myself lately. Getting lazy, or maybe that's the way it's going to be.
I have sort of a related question. So, sashin is really wonderful. Wow, that's quite an experience. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, and now I cannot sit for a month. So, but what I'm wondering is it really possible with daily sitting to recapture that what long periods of sitting does? You're shaking your head. No,
it's not. And it's not necessary.
Hmm. Why do you say that?
Because that's trying to get something. So we're just a part of a process, and part of the process is if we're fortunate and are able to sit one or two sessions a year, that we're reinforcing an experience that sashin provides, you could say. But if we go home and try to regenerate sashin mind, it doesn't work because there's so many distractions going on. And that we have to deal with, because there's nobody cooking our meals anymore and nobody keeping the world at bay. You know, we have to go out and do all those things. So it's the teaching always is to bring zazen mind, the samadhi mind, into whatever we're doing. So it's not just on the cushion, but that the mind of slicing an onion or washing the dishes or driving the car can be this same mind without the same intensity and lack of distraction. It's just accepting the distraction, accepting the foolishness of one's own mind and activity, the many mistakes that we make, you know, all of those things, becomes a part of the samadhi. So it becomes, in a way, because of sashin, our ordinary life becomes enriched because we're able to accept more of it and be more of it without trying to do what sashin does.
The more traditional lifestyle, was it more like sashin or more like our regular lives? Like monks who were devoted to study, did they I mean, sure, they lived in, free from the rest of the world, but they still had to make things work.
They sure did. Yes.
So is our daily life at all similar to that?
Yes.
Were they having the sashin experience all the time?
No. No. Yeah. No, but they were living with other people who were doing the same thing, so they were reinforced in that way. If you're with 25 or 30 other people who are all sitting together every morning and every evening, which is what they do, mm-hmm. and then you're working together during the day, then there becomes a cohesion, a real sangha kind of feeling, even though there's not very much talking at all. Everybody is a part of the same scene. And for us, we have to bring our practice into a world where not many other people are doing the same thing. So it's a little bit different that way. But we can still sit in the morning and evening and bring our sitting into whatever we do in the same way the monks do. They cook food, they clean, they they garden, they do everything that it takes to run a monastery. It's a big job.
Yes.
Yeah. And then once a month they have sashin. So they're sitting a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot more than we do. Koban said you can feel it. If you walk into the monastery, you can feel it. You can feel the zazen that's there. Just like at Tassajara when you went into the Zendo. It's been a sitting place for 30 years and you can't help but feel.
Yeah.
And new people who come here feel that also. And the strange thing is, and that's what Koban said, if you live at the monastery, you don't feel it anymore. So that's part of the secret of practice also, that if we want to feel it all the time, we won't. Even though it's happening through us constantly. So that's one of the things that's happening here is we're providing that feeling as well as the space. And people who are new come in and they can feel it. But for us, it's become so usual, it just feels, ordinary. But we're not so ordinary to others. Not in a special way, but just in a way. Well, we've got time to do some more sitting. Shall we do it? Okay, thank you.